now, not just one of 20, your number one mission is the enemy within, just as you are describing. And then he also told them, effectively, when he joked, he did it jokingly, but he effectively told them, you don't like it, resign, get out. So he has been reshaping and transforming the military pretty much from the day he took office, and even just pretty much from the day he won the election, because what he is doing in his recruitment, he's making it very, very clear what the new missions here are going to be. He's been very upfront about it. He's not really hiding things. He does it, and he's been doing it pretty much nonstop since he's won the election. So that means people who are volunteering to join, and it's not just the guard, the new recruits in the guard, or the new recruits for the U.S. military, of which there are over hundreds of thousands, 100,000 for sure since he's come. So it's a large number of people who have just come in the last 11 months here. But also, it would be with ICE, and it would be with the civilian part of DHS, it would be with the civilian part of the government in general. They all are now pretty well aware of what the new real agenda is. And now, what about the people that were already here? Well, at first, there was, quote unquote, the resistance. So you remember 9 months ago, we were talking about all the resistance. Well, Doge got rid of the resistance pretty quick. So the first couple hundred thousand people who went away that Doge fired, most of those were the actual resistance that was there. Now, what's been happening is there's been a shrinkage of what you might call the ambivalence. The people that were hoping to hold on, you know, just kind of outstay Trump, so to speak, here. Well, now what's happening is he's forcing them to make choices, and cleavages are going to start to occur. As these operations unfold, Ian, there will be undoubtedly more and more aggressive actions here that will harm ordinary people. They'll do it in varying degrees. So search and destroy operations always produce collateral damage. They produce varying degrees of collateral damage, because the military force that's being used here is really this is not policemen. These are what you are seeing are essentially what's called signature strikes. They're getting a general idea of who's in a building. They're not going to just arrest one person in a building. So these are the pattern of search and destroy operations, which always then have collateral damage on the edges, and you're starting to see some of that collateral damage being reported in the United States. Children in zip ties, people being, reporters being hit with tear gas and pellets, someone being shot and driving herself to the hospital. Well, this is just the beginning. I mean, we're only at the very early stages of this. If there really is going to be the deportation of 150,000 people out of the city of Chicago, about 2.7 million, here, this is just way the beginning. We've got to have months and months and months, and these operations will get bigger and bigger, and therefore the collateral damage will get worse and worse. And President Trump is talking not just about the 150,000 inside of the city of Chicago, but he's talking about the 500,000 in the state of Illinois. So this is really a large operation and agenda that he has, and this will create likely enormous collateral damage over time. That will create cleavages. This will create a new relationship between the United States people and its military, and it will be a negative relationship, and it will become likely, unfortunately, an increasingly hostile relationship. So these search and destroy operations, Ian, in other countries, these are gigantic losers. They almost never work. They almost always create more problems, more terrorists, so to speak, than they stop, more bad guys than they ever stop. And the reason is because of the collateral damage and how this impinges upon ordinary businesses. So if you have giant raids happening in neighborhoods, it's not just bad guys don't want to go to the jewel in the grocery store. Nobody wants to.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Andy Whoa looks a scream, hand him on my whoa. Andy Whoa, silver stream, can't tell them apart at all.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week are Chris Rauschenberg and Kristen Solomon. Chris is the co-founder of Blue Sky Gallery, and Kristen is the executive director. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again.
It's always a pleasure.
Really excited to be on the show. Thank you for having us.
So this show, Blue Sky, 1975 to 1985, it's on now through November the 1st, and it's first of five retrospectives of what this gallery's been doing for 50 years. So this is the 70s, 80s show, and you basically tried to get in touch with all the people you'd shown, all these photographers, wherever they are in the world. You found them, you got their prints, and you printed them yourselves, and you're showing them off to the next generation.
That's correct, yeah. This is a little over 50 artists in this show, out of, I don't know, 150 probably, that that we were trying to find. It's three prints that were in their show in, you know, 40 to 50 years ago. And then we also said, hey, you're probably tired of your old work. What have you been doing recently? What have you done since then that you would really like to show? Mm-hmm. So it's a chance for the artists to look back to their past, but also to express their present.
Mm-hmm. So as you come in the gallery, you know, it's a big room divided down the middle by these black benches. And everything on the right is sort of old work, and then the same artist showing newer work on the opposite side. So you can kind of look back and forward and keep track of where you are. And kind of right by the original poster of the original show is Ford Gilbreth. And these are sort of street scenes, black and white. People, blurry, bald guy, old lady in a crowd, another guy with shades on in the winter, rainy scenes. This is kind of how I think of photography in the 70s.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, Ford is one of the best photographers in the country. We've shown him a number of times, and I think he's in this show first 10-year retrospective. I think he's in it three times. I think he had three shows in our first decade. And very different kinds of work. As you say, this first show was very sort of urban street photography. But then he's from Hopkinsville, Kentucky originally, so he has a sort of a rural point of view and has done a lot of really interesting work. One of the things later on in the show he's walking around outdoors with a scanner, like a tabletop scanner attached to a battery, holding it up to plants and making plant portraits with a scanner. He's liable to do anything. He did a whole series of pictures walking around with a fish tank, wading around in the water, taking pictures that were half above the water and half below.
So the fish tank was dry. The camera was dry, but it was semi-submerged.
Yeah. But then shooting through it so you could see the water line and see above it and below it.
Mm-hmm. And the very first show, you've got this beautiful poster. It says Blue Sky, and there's, of course, a cloudy sky behind a house. I mean, it's a group show, so, you know, there are names there. There's Chris Rauschenberg, Terry Todemeyer, people from Portland. So when you opened the gallery, you were going to be just Portland, and then it kind of grew from there.
Yeah, we thought we would start with the Northwest. I mean, it's funny because we were inspired, as many things are, by the space. Ann Hughes and Bob DeFranco were sharing a dark room, and the front two rooms, it was a storefront, they were in the third room. The first two rooms had weavers with looms set up. And the weavers left, and then there were these rooms, and rather than take on another roommate who would have to walk through the dark room to get to the bathroom, which is not what you want if you're in the dark room, Ann sort of said, well, maybe we'll put some pictures up. And Craig Hickman, who's another of the co-founders, said, well, we could kind of have a gallery. And Ann thought about it and said, well, that's a good idea. Then if a photographer came to town, they'd come into the gallery and we'd meet them. So it was like a honey trap, if I can put it that way. You know?
In the 70s, there were so many people getting together, creating these grassroots organizations, nonprofits, doing amazing things. To this day, not many of them have lasted this long. So I think it's incredible that Blue Sky is around to celebrate 50 years, and we hope to be around for another 50 years.
And the idea is, found all the old art, as many as you could, and you downloaded, in most cases, prints?
So we had them send us image files, and for some people that was a reason they just, you know, this time everyone was shooting on film, nobody was having digital cameras back in the 70s, and some people were just too technically complicated, and they weren't able to participate for that reason, but for the ones who are in the show, they send us image files. We send them to a lab that does very good work in Minnesota, actually, and had them make 11 by 14s of everything, which just seemed like a size that we could fit. But it's also, in the original gallery history, all the shows were 11x14s in the first year or two, because that's how big people printed.
Chris, try and describe the vibe, as it's called, as it used to be called and now is again, of the 70s and a bunch of young photographers starting out, just wanting to be shown, wanting to see each other's work, wanting to socialize, and just wanting to be photographers. Maybe they weren't in the media, or they weren't, you know, in a university. Yeah. They were living their lives, but they loved taking pictures on film. Were there any barriers to just getting a show? Was photography taken seriously?
Photography was not taken seriously, was not shown. And, you know, the Museum of Modern Art showed photography. The Portland Art Museum actually had a bit of a photography collection. They were unusual in that regard. But outside of New York and San Francisco, there really weren't photography galleries. We were part of a little cluster that started in 1974, 1975. It was Lightwork Gallery in Syracuse, San Francisco Camera Work. There was Light Factory in Charlotte. There was a little, like, Seven Sisters or something. Mm-hmm. That all started around the same time. Mm-hmm. Houston Center for Photography, a little bit younger. But normal painting galleries, if I can use that term, didn't show photography, and to this day don't. I mean, if you think of the galleries in Portland, Elizabeth Leach shows photography. One of her first shows was Henri Cartier-Bresson, one of the greats of photography. But the other galleries basically don't show photography.
Laura Vinson has a few photographers.
She, yes.
Yeah, that actually she, I think, discovered through Blue Sky and the Drawers program. Yeah.
Good, yeah. We were just, here was this space. The Weavers moved out. Here was this space. Let's put pictures up. And we thought we'd show local photographers, but everybody was interested. And we would go down to San Francisco, because that was a real, Portland and San Francisco were the two big hotbeds of photography. We would go down there and find photographers and bring them up and show them. To us, it was really exciting. And we never thought, oh, you know, this will go on. We never thought we'll make money. We actually, when we started the gallery, we said, okay, let's agree to just assume that we're never going to sell a single thing, so that we never make a decision based on, well, we don't really like these pictures, but they'll sell well. We didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. We were kind of coming from a place of curiosity and enthusiasm rather than practicality. And we were pooling unemployment checks. The rent was only $40 a month. Hmm. And, you know, we just did it. And you were noticing earlier that the posters, many of them don't have the year on them, because we didn't think, well, 1970s. We're not going to still be around in 1976 or 77, are we? You know, and that was a big change when we, in 2007, we did a capital campaign. We bought our space, and suddenly it's like, oh, look, are we still going to be around next year? It was like, oh, if I had kids, maybe my grandkids could come here. It really changed our view, and we've now been around a very significant percentage of the history of photography, so we've had to readjust our thinking that way.
So I moved here 30 years ago, and I remember going to Blue Sky, and you said it was on Lovejoy. Was that there only location?
By the time you came, we weren't on Lovejoy. We were only there for a couple of years. And then we lost that lease because the whole block turned into a bank, that whole corner. But there were two other arts nonprofits in town, Portland Center for the Visual Arts, mm-hmm. and the Northwest Artists Workshop. And we moved in. We became subletters for the Northwest Artists Workshop. Mm-hmm. And we were there for some years. I don't remember how many. And then they lost their lease, and we moved up one floor mm-hmm. and sublet space from Portland Center for the Visual Arts. And then they, in 1988, they went out of business. They closed. And we got our own space up at 12th and Hoyt. And we were there for 20 years, and now we've been here for 17 years. So when you first came, we would have been on Hoyt.
Yeah, it was a little pearl building, you know, not very small.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great space. And Al Solheim, who was our landlord's arts patron, and he's really one of our biggest arts patrons because he charged us very little rent. I mean, in 2007, when we did our capital campaign and moved out from that to here, our rent was all the way up to $1,000 a month. This is the Pearl District. That rent, the market rate, would have mm-hmm. been unbelievably higher than that. So he was really subsidizing us every month. And, mm-hmm. and when we moved in here, Jim Winkler put this building together for us and sold us our space in it. And so, you know, people say bad things about property developers, but property developers who are arts patrons are really important in the ecosystem of the arts.
Yeah, we could use more of those people this day in the city, really seeing the opportunity with the empty buildings downtown as a space to develop for artists and arts organizations. I think the cool thing about Blue Sky is that still to this day, it operates on a very similar structure. When the gallery opened, they thought they would just be showing local photographers, but very quickly started getting proposals in from all over the country, eventually all over the world. And that tradition continues in the fact that we, because we have an incredible exhibitions committee, they meet every week to look at the work that comes in, proposals. We accept proposals. We have no deadlines. There's no fee. Anyone at any time can present their work to Blue Sky to be considered to go on the walls here. So I think that that's something that not everybody typically knows, and it's not very common for any gallery, let alone photography gallery. Usually there's a curator, there's some sort of gatekeeper, yeah. But here, anyone can be on the committee as long as they're a member of Blue Sky. Mm-hmm. So that's what's great, is that then it kind of keeps the barrier really low. And because we're a nonprofit, we get to show work that we think is interesting and wonderful, and we're not beholden to, you know, the commercial viability of the images. Mm-hmm.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week are Christopher Rauschenberg and Kristin Solomon of Blue Sky Gallery. They're here talking about Blue Sky 1975 to 1985, which is on now through November the 1st. So this room, the first room we're in is, you know, it's very bright, a lot of bright colors. But there is that sort of, some of them have that kind of yellowish orange tone that I always think of as, you know, as old prints.
Yeah, well, is what you're looking at over here that's kind of orangish is those are Polaroid SX-70s. And when the Polaroid SX-70 came out, a lot of artists started using it. Like I say, whenever there's a new technological opportunity, people explore it, you know.
So these are square with a white paper border.
Yeah. And it was a camera. You took a picture and it spat out the little print out of the bottom. Mm-hmm. And I know Ann Hughes and Craig Hickman, who are two of the gallery founders, became very deeply involved in that. And then Craig decided that he wanted to not have a unique object. He wanted to be able to make a new print of something. So he taught himself to make color prints. You know, from negatives in the dark room and everything. Oh. But yes, I think for a lot of people, the Polaroid SX-70, like I say, was an entry into color at a time when it was hard to do color. And we actually had here in Portland a wonderful lab that people would travel into town to print it. You develop a photo lab that they would help you print color, and they had big machines, and it was a great place. And like I said, people would come in from Montana, from wherever to print there, yeah. The letter U dash developed, yeah. Okay.
The ones we're looking at are by Linda Goff.
Yeah.
So she has a guy with a funny hat on and glasses and a funny mustache. He's wearing dungarees and he's sort of wrestling with a stool. It's like between his legs. The next one, it's pinning him down, and then it's sort of finally is on his back and it's lying on his head. So this was, you know, spontaneous kind of art.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's a way in which photography can be very spontaneous. I mean, you can take a picture in a 60th of a second. Now, it takes longer than that to figure out if it's a good picture or not. But yeah, photography has this very sort of low-risk entry point, in a sense that, you know, I could go out today and take 100 pictures and look at them tonight and go out tomorrow and take 100 other pictures based on what I did today. So it's like fruit flies or like, viruses, you know. The power of evolution is really strong in photography. You can do a lot. I mean, you know, I say I can do 100 pictures in a day, and that's not an exaggeration. If you're a novelist or a sculptor, you're not going to make 100 novels in a day or in a lifetime. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have this opportunity for iterative learning in photography, and you have the freedom to do something stupid. I had a class that I was teaching at Merrillhurst University, and at the beginning of class, I said, okay, here's how the grading is going to work. You come in, if you want an A, shoot 3 rolls of film every week and bring in 15 prints. If you want a B, shoot 2 rolls of film and bring in 10 prints. If you want a C, shoot 1 roll of film and bring in 5 prints. Do you understand? And one student raised their hand and they said, well, but what if we just take a whole bunch of stupid pictures? I said, you get an A. Because those pictures that come from this place of joy and freedom and exploration and curiosity, those are going to lead you somewhere. If you're saying, I mean, it's one of the things that changed photography was the 35 millimeter camera when Leica and the 35 millimeter cameras came in, where, you know, I mean, I remember once hearing Joel Meyerowitz, a very well-known photography shoot with an 8x10 camera. He said, every time I push that shutter, it's $20. And I'm not paying it. Somebody else has to pay it. So it's like, okay, you're never going to take a good picture again. You've lost all your iterative learning. I'm going to make a picture if I know it's good. Well, if you know it's good, you already done it. You're just repeating yourself. So for me anyway, one of the things about photography that I think is behind its power is this iterative learning, that it's, you can just take a picture and, like, here's a picture of mine that's in the show. This is two girls, and the mother wanted me to do a classic sort of portrait of them sitting on this love seat.
So it's two girls on a stripy couch, but you've cropped them so you just get half of one girl's face on the right and just a quarter, just the mouth of the other girl. And they're little blondies, probably under seven. Yeah. And so why did you do crop them?
So I took the picture that she wanted me to take, but then I took this picture. I was working at the time with what happens if you get really close to things with a wide-angle lens. Wide-angle lens gives you a lot of depth of field, and so a lot of things are in focus. And it's like, I want to take a picture of what it would be like a bug's eye view or something, you know, to get really close into something. And I took this picture, and when I brought her the picture that she had wanted, she opened a box and said, oh, this is great. There's something else in here. And she looked, and here was this sort of goofy picture of, as you say, a quarter of one of her daughters and half of the other. She went, oh, this is for me too. Thank you. And then the next time I was up there, this is the one that she had hanging in her office.
Really?
Yeah.
I love these super brightly colored pictures in the second room in the far right-hand corner. It's a baby sitting on very reflective plastic, you know, mylar. Like mylar. He's naked and someone's pouring like chocolate sauce or something onto his hand from out of a TV. I don't know what's real in that picture. Then there's another one that seems to be the same kid three times in a little red dungarees with a yellow top, and he's dangling on a staircase. He's playing with stuffed toys. He's crawling up a staircase. And the bottom picture is a guy in very 70s, jeans, shirt off, and he's in a dark room, and he's got a naked baby on the enlarger, and then another baby over in the developing tank, you know, where the water would be, and it's all in beautiful red glow.
Yeah, it's Vance Gellert, and he was a father of a young baby, and his wife was a doctor, so she was the one who went back to work, and he was the stay-at-home dad, and during the day when she was gone, he would make these elaborate setups. And when she came home, she would help him make the picture because they wanted to keep the baby safe. And some of the pictures, one of the pictures of the baby is about to crawl into a bunch of broken glass. One of them, he's heading toward a hibachi with big flames coming out of it. So it was you wanted the whole safety team there. But they were expressing kind of the anxieties and the things that you have, the feelings that you have as a parent of a young baby. It's like, I don't know anything, and I have to keep this baby alive, you know. And that were really exciting pictures. And we really, when we had our 10th birthday show, his work was the one on the post.
When you were approached by a new photographer, did you see their work before you met them as a personality?
Generally, yes.
And was there, if they were a bit of a dud in person, would that affect whether you showed them or not?
No. But actually, it's interesting.
If you like the work, forget about the person.
Yeah, if we like the work, we show it. We're not worried about the other stuff. So, but I will say that, you know, photography is literally looking at the world through someone else's eyes. And that expression is usually a way of talking about empathy. So I think photographers, by and large, I mean, there are some jerky photographers, but not many. Photographers generally have been trained by their medium to think, okay, how would this feel to you? You know, what is your reaction if I do this? You know, you're not going to like that, so I'm not going to do it. So photographers tend to be really nice, and photographers also tend to not have any money. So if you say, oh, I'm going to be in Chicago, they say, oh, you stay with us, you know, sleep on our sofa, you know. There's this real sort of team spirit in photography as a medium that I love.
Is there any kind of balance in this, in your work, you know, in the Blue Sky, especially in the early days, between like photojournalism and pure art, kind of messing around photography?
Yeah, we didn't have as much photojournalism. Over the years, of course, we've had a certain amount. But it tends to be more sort of goofy art photography, I would say. We certainly have done a lot of shows that are about sort of border issues with us in Mexico or about various things like that. But, you know, in the early years, one of the things that was really noticeable to me, and looking back at it, it's even more noticeable, is we had hardly any photographers of color. For somebody who's in the art world now, they would say, what is this all-white thing, you know? But the art world was very all-white, and we always showed a lot of women photographers, but the art world was not so welcoming to women in the larger art world. But we were very excited by the sort of domestic documentary that I was just talking about, Vance Gellert, who was a man doing it. But if you're interested in what's going on at home with the baby, it makes a lot more room to have women artists in your gallery. But also there was just, you know, we just weren't prejudiced against them. It's like, yeah, women are, they're just as good as anybody else. You know, what the heck, you know? You will see, as the decade shows progress, you'll see more and more artists of color. But this early show is very lily white.
Coming into Blue Sky, I've always felt, is a little window on America and, you know, the rest of the world, because you're just seeing things you never see. What was that show here based in Beirut about all the economic crisis and people trashing ATMs and stuff? Yeah. I didn't even know that was happening.
Yeah, we've had a few shows that were about Lebanon and Beirut. We had Sophie Ristelhuber. We've done actually a few things like that because I think, you know, as you say, photography is a way to look at familiar things in an unfamiliar way, but it's also a chance to look at things that aren't part of your daily life. You know, you and I haven't been to Beirut, but we have it in our head. We know something about it because we see it in photographs. We haven't been to the moon, but we've been there in photography, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that photography, the way that it defeats time and space, and by space I don't just mean physical space, I also mean the spaces between us as we are alienated from each other or just separate from each other. So I think photography and film are the most powerful ways for people to get to know what else is going on in the world. That's part of what my fascination for photography was, is you're going to empower me to see things that I would never have seen otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that photography lends itself to, you know, any art, self-expression and storytelling. And so people are getting to share their narratives with others, and then we're seeing the world through their eyes, and we're having a better understanding of people that are different than us. And so I wake up every day, I always say, like, I wake up every day, like, really proud of the work that we do here at Blue Sky, because ultimately we're a part of bringing understanding, cultural understanding, awareness into the world, and ultimately social change. Some of the shows that have been on Blue Sky have talked about really important issues, and part of our mission is dialogue. So that's the dialogue, also the conversations that happen that on the EC when we're on the exhibition committee, when we're looking at the work to approve it, or the artist talks. We do an artist talk every month here with artists on the main walls. And so the conversations that come out of the learning from others, I think, is really important. And we need more of that in the world right now.
Yeah, and we have a multi-generational exhibition committee. So I think that the structure of an exhibition committee that has younger people coming on with, okay, this is what my generation is interested in, mm-hmm. I think is really important. It's what's kept the gallery fresh. It's what's kept it relevant and moving into the present and future.
So you said, Chris, that you've been working on a website to try and sample at least every single show you ever had here. And you can pull it up on your phone. Well, you will be able to, maybe when this is out in early October. Walking through here, I feel like I'm in Instagram, where you've just got a barrage of images, and you're kind of used to processing them quite quickly. What do you think people in the 70s would have thought of Instagram?
There's a strength to Instagram in that it's very democratic and you can post pictures and people can see them, but it has a commercial base. And so you pretty quickly realize, well, wait a minute, I'm just being shown a bunch of advertising, and there's these, I'm being steered toward things that I've looked at before, and the opportunity to discover something new is being denied to me by the algorithm.
Yeah, the algorithm kind of killed Instagram, I think, yeah. You know, because now you're just being, you know, fed, you're in an echo chamber, you know, and I think when it first started, it was really exciting. The idea of every artist could just have their own free little platform. People didn't even have websites. They were like, oh, we just do this. And discovering new art, it was a great way to discover new art. And I think it's a little bit harder now because of that flood. But it ultimately, I I think the great thing about the technology is that it's brought people closer together and bringing this kind of, Chris was talking about before, about the space issue. I think that it's
the distance between us.
Yeah, this, it's shortened the distance between us in a lot of ways. And I think including artists finding out about Blue Sky and sending us proposals. And I think that one of the coolest things is that a lot of the emerging artists that we've shown lately have never printed their work. And getting a solo show at Blue Sky is the first time that they've ever seen their work bigger than a screen. Yeah. Some of them photograph on their phones. Some of them, you know, or if they're photographing on their computer, you know, they're not necessarily looking at their work that big or even printing it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fascinating to kind of give artists that opportunity to go, okay, let's play with scale, or getting it off the digital space and onto the walls, which is why, again, I think it's really important that Blue Sky exists and stick around. Having a physical space to come and look at photography, it's way different.
I mean, I love this place because I was here a month or two ago and you had large format photography. You know, it was these girls dressed as models in pink and stuff all over the place. Very posed, very stylized, but just giant prints. And I just thought, how wonderful for an artist to be able to print that big and have people stop and look. It's not like a bus shelter ad, you know. Plus, you do all the other stuff with, like, the draws. You encourage younger artists to get their foot in the door.
But what you just said about stop and look is really important. I mean, that's where we're bringing something that Instagram is not bringing. Instagram, you know, if you stop to do something, you look back, and the picture you were looking at a minute ago is now 800 screens back, is gone, you know?
Or people just scroll so quickly, they don't even get the time to really.
So for me, I've found myself sounding like a curmudgeon, saying, what's the matter with these young people? They're just looking at Instagram. Don't they want to know what's been going on in the last decades in photography? Mm-hmm. And then I went, well, wait a minute, what do I expect them to look at? You know, Beaumont Newhall's History of Photography that was written when their grandparents were young? I mean, no, there's nothing. So I said, okay, so we have to make something. So here we are. We've had over 1,000 shows in 50 years, and I want to go in and make a good web page for every one of those shows so that somebody who's a young photographer who's curious about the possibilities of the medium, they can say, wait a minute, look at this crazy guy, Vance Gellert, printing his baby, you know, under an enlarger, putting it in the tray. What the heck, you know? So I want them to have a place to go to stumble upon somebody that they never heard of doing something exciting.